Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, March 1st. What? It's already March 1st, 2021, and I'm the host of the show, Kara Santa Maria. And before we dive into this week's episode, I just want to thank those of you who help continue to make Talk Nerdy 100% free to download for anybody who wants to listen to the show. My show relies on a combination of support from ad sales and from listeners just like you. And if you want to pledge your support, all you've got to do is visit patreon.com/talknerdy. You can pledge as little as $1 per episode or as much as you want. This week's top supporters include Michael Gaucher, Mary Neva, Scott Sanders, Leonard Prince, Christopher Pitts, June Sapara, Pasquale Gelati, Ulrika Hagman, Dudas Infinitas, Brian Holden, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Daniel Lang, David J. E. Smith, Robert Christ, and Elise Christie. And I know you're used to hearing a lot of those names, but we've got a new one this week, Scott Sanders. Welcome, welcome, and thank you so much from the bottom of my heart. All right, we've got a great episode, and I was kind of grappling with what to call this episode. I didn't know if I wanted to call it feminist philosophy or gender-affirming philosophy. I went with feminist philosophy because I think that's a more well-accepted term within like scholastic communities. But this week's episode is a deep dive with Dr. Carol Hay. She's an associate professor in the Department of Philosophy at the University of Massachusetts, Lowell. And her most recent book is called Think Like a Feminist, The Philosophy Behind the Revolution. It's a great intro to feminist theory, but of course we dig even deeper than that. And we talk a lot about sex. We talk a lot about gender. We talk a lot about oppression. And we talk a lot about, you know, some of the difficulties in understanding the jargon, the literature, and questioning our own beliefs and being open to evolving and being more accepting, more humble, and more celebratory of diversity, not just in views, but in personal identity. This is, I really identified with this conversation. It meant a lot to me. I hope that it's salient for you as well. So I'm going to stop talking about it. I'm going to stop being so meta and let's just dive into it. Here she is, the author of Think Like a Feminist, The Philosophy Behind the Revolution, Dr. Carol Hay. Well, Carol, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I'm super excited to talk about your newest book. And of course, this is not your first book. The book is called Think Like a Feminist, The Philosophy Behind the Revolution. But it's not your first book. You also wrote Kantianism, Liberalism, and Feminism, Resisting Oppression. I am super thrilled to have you on the show today. I think you have a lot of great ideas that a lot of people need to hear. And honestly, 100%, we don't talk about philosophy enough in our day-to-day lives.
I think you probably do. I think you probably just might not call it that. I think philosophy is something that a lot of people, especially a lot of sort of reflective, inquisitive people, like it seems like you and your listenership are, I think philosophy actually comes up a lot, like all the time. It just might not necessarily be something that we label as such.
Oh, you're so right. I mean, it's interesting because it's true. There's this sort of self-referential aspect of philosophy. Like now I'm doing philosophy. I'm doing an academic enterprise and I'm maybe following certain rules and I'm reflecting back on thinkers before me. But philosophy is at the seat of kind of all thought.
Yeah. Yeah. And in some ways it's just, I mean, I wouldn't even, or I think I would actually have a hard time even defining philosophy. I think in some ways it's a sort of orientation to the world, an openness to question things, to look for the reasons behind things. And so in that ways, I think philosophy and science are really similar. I don't know if you know this, but MC Hammer has become sort of famous on philosophy Twitter for, turns out dude's got this like interest in philosophy and he's like following all these philosophers on Twitter. And it becomes a badge of honor when MC Hammer follows you. He has not followed me yet. Maybe he will after this. One can hope.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah, exactly. But he was, making waves in the philosophy Twitter sphere recently, taking on someone who is sort of shitting on philosophy and saying, no, science is where it's at. And MC Hammer comes in and is like, no, these things are of a piece, right? These things like work together. And like, but yeah, I guess MC Hammer is now our spokesman, which is pretty great.
that's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so true, yet you're right. There's this kind of weird sometimes battle. And I don't even know if it happens in most people's minds. I think it might happen more in like skeptic circles where we know that philosophy was the sort of original discipline and it was all the other disciplines combined prior to a defining of modern sort of scientific thought and the scientific method, which of course is only one epistemology. It's like one way of thinking. It's just a way of thinking that we're all really, really proud of and has falsifiability. And we feel like is one of the best ways to approximate whatever it is you want to call truth, if and when it's appropriate. But there are many instances where we can't use science because it's outside of the realm of the type of inquiry we're doing.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. That's right. My students, I get a lot of sort of students into my intro classes, and I see them coming in with this preconception about what their philosophy class is going to be. And so I'm always there up at the front of the classroom on the first day going, I know that you think that this is just going to be like bong hits you with your roommate at 2 a.m. And that's not the kind of philosophy we're going to do. Okay.
That's the kind of philosophy we're all doing in our day-to-day life.
There's definitely a time for that, especially during the pandemic.
So I've got to ask then, okay, so you teach intro to philosophy. How great is that? Because it brings us back to basics. And sometimes those intro classes that we think of as being, you know, oh, it's an intro class. It's a 101. It's easy. It's foundational. No, that's everything. It's got so much breadth. It just doesn't have quite as much depth.
That's right. That's right. So I usually teach an intro ethics class, which I completely love because it's this opportunity to, I don't know, maybe it's narcissism, but like you can get these people in these really sort of impressionable times in their lives and you can give them just stuff to chew on, stuff to think about that they really can come back to for the rest of their lives. And I've been teaching now long enough that, you know, I occasionally get students who I taught, you know, 10, 15 years ago, you know, sending me an email and saying, hey, I remember that paper that you signed. I still think about it. And that's just really gratifying as a teacher. So that makes me feel really, really happy to be able to do the kind of work that I do. And then again, the feminism sort of, it becomes part of that because just as I can sort of give people a new way to kind of think about the moral dilemmas they might face in my intro ethics class, I always find ways to sneak feminism in somewhere. The F word, as I call it. And you really do have this chance to just, again, I'm not out there to convert them to feminism. I'm just out there to sort of present these ideas. And in my experience, when you actually have the ideas presented to you in a way that's understandable, when you can kind of weed through all of the misconceptions, this stuff is really pretty plausible and really, it's the kind of thing that a lot of different people who have a lot of different backgrounds and a lot of different personalities really, really can incorporate into their lives.
Yeah, yeah, it's so true. But the funny thing is that when we think about philosophy, more of the academic side of philosophy, not so much the day-to-day inquiries and grapplings that we have, but the academic side of philosophy, I don't think that feminism is the first word that comes up in most people's minds, especially. I just did a deep dive recently on existentialism existential psychology for a live show for the SGU. And I did this like quick and dirty, the history of these psychological movements and these philosophical movements. And they were all dudes. Every single person I referenced was a dude because women only sadly got recognition for being on the scene within the past few decades, really,
yeah.
Right?
It's been shocking. And it's, I mean, so like, I'm not that old, right? Like I'm in my early 40s and just to see the representation of women explode in my academic lifetime has been shocking, right? So just, and even the idea of being able to do feminist philosophy, like when I was in grad school, I was told that's not philosophy. Like you have to do ethics or something. You can't do feminism. No one will hire you, right? And so feminism was a sort of side project that sort of slowly took over as I sort of got more steam. But yeah, the philosophy itself, it remains very, very dude heavy. Actually, people have sort of crunched the numbers and there are fewer women with tenure in philosophy departments than in any other academic departments across the country, other than, I believe, physics and one of the engineerings, maybe electrical engineering. But other than that, literally, all of the sciences are doing better in terms of gender representation than philosophy is still. And don't even get me started on the representation of people of color, right? It's definitely still an old white boys club. But tons of progress is being made. So I am optimistic.
And, you know, a lot of that progress is being made by bringing these conversations to light within those departments. So, you know, I can only imagine that the reason that you were told as a grad student, this is not a field, is because it kind of wasn't a field and you needed to pave your own path.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was sort of maybe the sort of second or second and a half generation of women who were trying to do feminist stuff and have that be taken seriously. I think what's sort of interesting now is now that the zeitgeist is changing and feminism, I think, is sort of entering the mainstream of society in general as well, like with the Me Too movement and these sorts of things. What we're seeing within academic philosophy is these questions of gender, gender identity, sexuality, these sorts of things that feminists have been talking about for probably 40, 50 years. Now they're being taken up by more mainstream philosophers who act as if they've discovered this stuff. And
oh,
they're not
no.
reading our stuff. And so now we're like, oh my God, you guys.
God. Yep. And this is one of the real failures of a lack of multidisciplinary thinking, but I think also a lack of, I don't know. Tell me if you think I'm conceptualizing this appropriately, if I'm even being broad enough. At the most foundational level, sort of the most basic level of what it means to be a feminist thinker or what it even means to give a shit about gender representation, there's this idea throughout most of human, actually all of human history, that the male perspective was the normative perspective and the female perspective was other. So like man comes first, man is normal. Female or any other gender minority, whether it be, you know, any version of a trans identity or a non-binary identity, is other. And so we compare it to male as the norm. I mean, is that really where most of these problems kind of exist?
That's definitely one big source of that. So the bit of academic jargon that that exists to describe what you've so nicely articulated is androcentrism. Right. So androcentrism is the view that, again, as you say, what it is to be human is to be male and women are this sort of like weird and deviant other. Right. And so actually an existentialist philosopher, Simone de Beauvoir, articulates this really, really nicely. She says man is always the subject and women is only is always the object. I've bungled that that quotation. It's more nuanced than that. But we see that even in sort of early feminist philosophers articulating this idea that we think of what it is to be human as sort of coextensive with what it is to be male. And of course, like when we articulate it that way, that sounds bizarre, right? And of course, no one would admit to thinking that explicitly, right? But there are ways that you can kind of see that this view is kind of lurking in the background of our mind, even if we don't necessarily explicitly acknowledge it, right? So I like to point out that and gender-neutral language is a really nice example of this, right? So with man or mankind has two meanings, right? It can mean everybody, all human beings, or it can mean just men, right? Whereas womankind only ever means women, right? That's just sort of a way it pops up in our language. And again, this is why so many feminists insist on gender-neutral language, because we're trying to undo that. But it pops up in other really, really kind of crazy places too, right? So I'd like to point to the Smurfs sometimes. Right. Think about this. Remember the Smurfs from when you were a kid, right? Those little blue guys.
Oh, they're
right?
Yeah, they're all dudes, right. And then there's one girl.
Then there's one, exactly. Right. So Smurfette, right? So like to be a woman is to be like, you know, handy or brainy or whatever, right? It's like this. It's this thing that you can do, but what you really are is a Smurf, right? So it's a form of androcentrism, right? We see it a lot actually in media representations or cultural representations of what it is to be human, right? So there's a famous test that a cartoonist named Alison Bechdel came up with 20 years or more ago at this point. It's called the Bechdel test. And she basically says that you want to look at a movie and you want to ask yourself, does this movie have at least one conversation between two women about something other than a man? So that's the test. Again, this is a pretty low bar, right?
Very low
actually
bar.
Shockingly hard. To find movies that pass this test. Apparently fewer than 50% of movies even now pass this test, right? Like you can talk to a grocery store clerk about the weather and it counts. But were you to flip it, were you to say, okay, this is a movie that has to have at least one conversation between two men about something other than a woman. Well, that's all the movies, right? Because these movies, they're cultural reflections of, you know, of who we are, what we think, you know, who we think we are, right? And so these stories that we're telling ourselves about ourselves right, involve the idea of, you know, there has to be like an everyman person that this movie is appealing to. And that everyman is a man, right? Men aren't expected to be able to identify with a female protagonist, right? Then it's a chick flick, then it's not taken seriously, right? Whereas women are very good at identifying with male protagonists because we've had to, because all of culture has historically been made for men. And if we were going to get to, you know, enjoy and like, you know, crack a book and enjoy it at all, it was going to happen by learning how to identify with a male protagonist. And like, we're not just necessarily talking about high art, right? We're talking about Winnie the Pooh, yeah. Right? Kids learn this, right?
Everything. Well, and that is the point, right? That it's there from the time we're born. It's the messaging that we receive consistently. And like you said, I think it's such an important point that bears repeating. It's not that we are just intrinsically thinking of male as normative and female as being compared to male. This is not a natural way that women think or that men think. This is a societal way that we've been induced and fostered and led to think. And we simply do it as women because there's no other way to do it.
That's right. Because this is what we're taught. And because this is the Kool-Aid we're all served up, you know?
Yeah.
And so we drink it. But I think, I mean, I'm sounding maybe overly pessimistic here now. I do think that this is changing, right? We're seeing progress. We're seeing a recognition that there are experiences other than those of cis, white, straight, middle-class men that people are hungry for. And so I do think in some ways, like, the zeitgeist is shifting, and I think it's shifting in really, really important ways.
So the kind of discomfort around the shifts, the resistance to the shifts, the reason that the shifts have taken so long and that this sort of issue is not an issue that just works itself out with time. You know, like, we've been around thousands of years and this has been the way it's always been up until very, very recently.
Recorded history, yes.
All of recorded history across cultures, by the way. The question is, you know, and maybe we can just make it explicit, like, why is it that this has maintained such steam and maintained such an ability to withstand the test of time? And why is there such a hard fight to try and push against it?
I think there are actually two questions here that they're related. One is this question of is why is this so entrenched? Mm-hmm. And I think the second question we can ask is, where did it come from in the first place?
Okay. Yeah.
Right. And so to the entrenchment question, I think we can actually just say power is really, really good at sustaining itself. And that's because people who have power aren't going to want to give it up unless they're forced to.
Right.
Right. And so there actually hasn't been any real incentive for those with the power to shift and give up that power. Right. And so that means that things just kind of keep going as they will, unless there is some kind of shock to the system. Right.
Right. Because it's not like it's not a bug. It's a feature. Like, people who are in power are the ones who create the systems. And even if it's not explicit, they create systems that will serve themselves because that's how people think.
So they create the laws, and the laws just happen to serve them, right? But again, in some ways, I think we can see the sort of history of human progress, right? As one of sort of realizing that, like, no, we don't want just a few elite people with all of the world's resources standing on the necks of everyone else, right? So there's been this historical move towards egalitarianism, towards democracy, these sorts of things. But then with that comes the inevitability of actually giving more people power. And so then to the first question of where this came from in the first place, I think it's a fascinating question. And I think it's one that we cannot, like, that by definition, we can't actually answer with certainty. Because what would answer that question is sort of in the realm of prehistory, right? We're talking about human civilizations before humans could write down what humans were doing.
Right.
We're talking about cave people, right? And so we're in the realm of kind of anthropological speculation here, right? These gender dynamics do seem to be fairly consistent across culture and across time. Not completely consistent. We do get some exceptions, but they are, by and large, the overwhelming rule that men tend to have more power in a society than women, right? And so we can sort of ask, like, well, why, right? And so John Stuart Mill, who's a dude, but actually one of the early liberal feminist philosophers, gives us a pretty plausible just-so story here. And he says, basically, it's basically a version of, like, might makes right, right? So basically, you know, the cavemen had the physical strength that they could then use to dominate the cave women. And they use that physical strength to like force women to obey, to compel them to obey, right? And then as society advanced, the physical force that men once had was then translated into a kind of social force, a kind of power that didn't require physical strength, right? But it continued in keeping women subjugated, right? And that's plausible, but again, like we can't know with certainty because this is all speculative, right? So sometimes evolutionary psychologists now like to kind of hop in and they take this sort of might makes right story, and they embellish it with this idea about, you know, like certain roles in sexual reproduction. Right. And basically the thought here is that, you know, the male cave people wanted to spread as much seed to as many of available females as possible, because that's the way, you know, sperm works. Right. And the female cave people wanted to sort of lock down one male to protect them. Right. And then those males didn't want to spend all of their time protecting someone else's kids. And so then they had this reason to sort of want to control women's fertility. And this is why we now see, even today, this obsession with women's virginity and with women's modesty, right? It's a kind of holdover from the cave people times when we didn't have paternity tests, right? And so the only way to really sort of make sure that a kid was yours was to control a woman so fully that she wasn't having sex with any other man.
Right? Yeah, which we still, totally see today.
Yeah, exactly. But now we have technology. We should get rid of that, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It definitely rocks. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like it feels reasonable from.
It does. But there's a concern from the psych crowd that there tends not to be a lot of reflection from a lot of the people writing that stuff about how these archetypes of male and female map on really, really, really nicely to these really regressive, shitty gender roles that, just happen to give men way more social power than women.
Right. Okay.
Right. And so you kind of get this, you throw up your hands, just, it's inevitable, right? You know, look, it's like, don't you believe in evolution? Come on, obviously, you know, men are supposed to have more power than women. And so we get a kind of a justification of a really, really regressive anti-feminist worldview coming out of what I think is a kind of like really speculative kind of science.
Yeah. Yeah. And so even if it, you know, we probably, like you said, we'll never know. This is all speculative. Even if we could know, and even if it played out that this was the origin story or that the origin story was different, do you think it ultimately matters? Do you think it ultimately has an effect on how we affect change today?
I think the question is, can we change?
Right.
That's the interesting question. Can we change and should we change? And those are the questions that feminists really want to tackle. And those are some of the big questions that I tackle and Think Like a Feminist, right? Because the thought is, if you think this is inevitable or if you think it's good, well, then, okay, fine. This book isn't for you.
Yeah.
Right. But if you think that we can change, right? And if you think that we should change, then okay, start turning the pages because I've got stuff to say.
Okay, so spoiler alert, we can and we should. And here's how to go about
exactly.
it.
Exactly. yeah.
And so, okay, let's assume, because I think both of us, not I think, I know for a fact, both of us feel that we can and we should change. And my hope is that every single person from the beginning listening to this podcast has at least an inkling that we can and we should change. But maybe there are people who are sitting here listening saying, I disagree. I think that men are implicitly and intrinsically more powerful, that men should be trusted with the harder decisions in this world, the bigger demands, and that women, by virtue of their biology and their, you know, some sort of intrinsic essence, simply cannot fulfill those roles and should maintain these very womanly gender roles. Let's say there's somebody who's listening who thinks in that way, or maybe not explicitly, has tendencies in that way, because, you know, the truth is we all do, sadly. We all have those biases.
So you're asking me what I have to say to those people?
I mean, or maybe what do you have to say to the small voice that's inside of your own head? I'm wondering, how often do you use that small biased voice inside of your own head that's a product of her socialization? You know, what do you do as a thinker when that voice comes up and you're like, shit, even I'm falling victim to this?
Yeah. No, I mean, I think I like how you articulated that, because it, you're right that it's inevitable, right? That like, this is just, you know, this is like a fish in water, right? It's everywhere, right? I get the philosophical term for this is gender essentialism, right? The idea that the genders have these distinct essences or natures, probably rooted in, so again, you can root these essences in different things. You can root them in biology. You can root them in a kind of theology, right? So like the Western monotheistic religions root these gender roles in a particular understanding of theology, right? There are different, you know, worldviews that you can root them in. But the result is the same, right? The idea is that men and women have these different complementary natures, right? Men are from Mars, women are from Venus. There was that awful pop psych book back in the 90s. And the thought is that everyone should just stay in their lane, right? And that society works best. Individual people are happier and society works better if everyone just follows the gendered scripts that are rooted in either biology or religion.
Which is true if you're only asking men.
Right. But, I mean, to be honest, again, this is one of these things where, like, I think one of the things you can start pointing out is that actually these roles are really restrictive and constraining even for men.
True. Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's true. By and large, men still come out on top. I'm not going to pretend that in the feminist utopia that I'm fighting for, that every single privileged man is going to have all of the privileges that he has now. Because no, some of this really is a zero sum game. Right. But some of it's not. Right. And So I think that you can point out that there are, when you start to really pay attention to how restrictive these gendered roles and expectations are, how demanding they are, right? I like to think of it as a set of carrots and sticks, right? There's carrots that you get for performing gender well, right? For acting as if, for being a good man, these sorts of things, right? And there are sticks, right? There's a hell of a lot of social ostracism and, I mean, just outright assault or even murder, right? That rains down on people who can't or won't play these scripts, right? And again, this infuses sexuality, right? So it determines like what kind of sexual experiences you can have. It determines what kind of romantic experiences you have. And it also just experiences like what kind of life you can have, right? What hobbies or what interests are open to you, right? Once you start really realizing how much of the world is closed off of you because of what happened the second you were born and people looked at your crotch.
Yeah.
Right. You can start to sort of think that, you know what, maybe the world would be better if we all had a little more freedom here. Right. Because again, once you start paying attention to just how ubiquitous this socialization is, right. Like go into a toy store, spend 8 seconds in a toy store and you start seeing just how much, from day one, we track kids into these parallel, tracks. Depending on, again, this obsession that we have with babies' genitals, right?
Yeah.
Why? It's really kind of strange when I'm teaching my philosophy classes, I often use this thought experiment where I get people to get the students to imagine themselves as aliens, mm-hmm. Look at human beings as if you were an alien, as if you didn't know anything about humans and you're trying to figure them out, right? What would you think about this particular practice, right?
Right.
Okay. We're a society that the second a new member of that society is conceived, we're hankering to know about its genitals. We're obsessed with its genitals, right? And then as soon as we find out what the genitals are, right? We think we've gotten all of this information about the kind of person that new human member of society is going to be, right? And then of course, then we proceed to spend a ton of time making damn sure that that kid ends up acting in the ways that we think that they just will act, right?
And it all happens under the radar too. It's so subtle.
It really is. Yeah. And I have to report, even once you've gone down this rabbit hole and you start seeing this stuff, it doesn't mean you stop doing this.
Oh, for sure.
Right. So I do this with cats. Like if you give me a cat and if it's a boy cat, I'm going to kind of rough and tumble it. And if it's a girl cat, I'm going to pet it really softly and be really sweet to it.
Yeah, right? And tell it how beautiful it is. Or
yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's my job to not do this stuff. When my daughter was born, I didn't dress her in pink or girly clothes, mm-hmm. because a lot of this stuff's kind of scratchy. Mm-hmm. And I wanted my baby to be covered with soft things and have animal ears on all of her hats. Right? and so she was just usually dressed in fuzzy jammies and tended not to be in pink colors. And so people would assume she was a boy. Mm-hmm. Right. And then, they would say, oh, your baby's so cute. Is she a girl or is it a girl or a boy? And I'd say, mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's so fun to watch, even the most seasoned baby snuggler just be like, they don't know what to do with your kid.
Well,
because it, like, they need to know whether it's got a penis or a vagina so they know how to treat the baby. And like, that's weird. That's just weird.
It's so weird. And I have such a perfect example, like a manifestation of this in my life. I have two friends who are brilliant and wonderful people who, when they found out that that she was carrying a child, they decided, we're going to, until this child wants to identify, we're going to raise this child as gender neutral as possible. And they did not disclose the child's gender to anyone. I mean, it wasn't, they weren't obsessive about it in the sense that if it was like, if somebody was like, I really want to know, they'd be like, then change the kid's diaper, you know, like, right, like do some right. work to earn the knowledge.
Yeah.
but not, it wasn't just a function of gender neutrality. It was actually gender diversity. They would put the baby in, you know, a dress one day and a spacesuit the next day and all the options. It wasn't about suppressing creativity. It was about being as inclusive as possible. And you know, early on, I think they called it an it because it was a baby. Like, they didn't really yeah. see that as obviously offensive as it would be to a fully formed human. But preferred pronouns for them were they. But I think they would say she and he also, and just were really kind of loosey-goosey about it. And two things that have come from this, because baby's still a baby, actually, like a getting to be a toddler now and still not, you know, identifying in any general direction. But two things came from this. The backlash that I would see of people yeah. rolling their eyes, like what I thought of as very progressive, very thoughtful individuals rolling their eyes or being like, oh, that's not going to work. Or even, oh, that's going to damage the child, blew my mind.
No, I floated the possibility of doing that when my daughter was born, mm-hmm. but my now ex-husband was not game. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I could see that because yeah. there would be a lot of pushback. Like, is this dangerous to the child's identity? Are we confusing the child as if somehow, or maybe because the social pressures are so strong that simply to challenge them at a fundamental level would be a burden that the child couldn't bear. Ugh, how sad is that?
It is. Yeah, I think there's a kind of like concern trolling where you're like, you know, oh, you're gonna damage the kid. You're gonna screw the kid up. When really, I think what's going on is just this expression of discomfort, right? Because we don't know how to interact with people with that, like, unless we're doing it through these gendered lenses. Or at least for the most part, we don't. We're getting better at it, I think, very, very slowly. And I think in part because of the efforts of people like your friends who are willing to really kind of like be on the vanguard of this. And I think like to the benefit of their child, right? That like that kid is going to have so much more like flexibility and openness and opportunities for creativity. And I loved how you said like not gender neutral, but like gender, like expressive, like all sorts of genders, right? Because I think like sometimes you talk, like people hear about the feminist ideal of androgyny. Which is what we're discussing here, right? Right. The idea that your sex, your biological sex, whether you have a penis or a vagina or these sorts of things, shouldn't necessarily map onto your social gender, right? So this ideal of androgyny sometimes gets, like, I think the first thing that pops into people's head is like some kind of like really non-sexy Star Trek Vulcan or something, right. Right? You know, where they're all the same.
Yeah.
Right. And it's like, no, seriously, like, and like, and that's not sexy. I don't, like, no one wants to fuck a Vulcan, right? and so therefore, right, like, that this is a really dangerous ideal, right? We're going to get rid of these really, really important gender roles that are really fundamental to our identity as a species, right? If we start messing with this stuff, right? Whereas I kind of want to be like, why on earth would you think that removing all of these constraints by minimizing the, like, all of the carrots, or rather minimizing all of the sticks, that exist that are waiting for people who step even a little bit out of the line when it comes to their gender performances. Why on earth would you think that minimizing that stuff would result in people acting the same?
Right.
Like it's it's exciting to think of all of the different creative options that exist for human self-expression. Once we, you know, like lighten up a little bit on this stuff. And this is why I think like the queer community, for example, is just like this source of massive, like imaginative strength, right? Like the queers know, right? We know like how to live, right? The sex is better, right? The relationships are better. The friendships are better. The life is better because you're just like, you're not quite so shackled by these really, really repressive constraints.
And it's sad to me to think that there's an entire segment of the population who is for whom these concrete gender roles are so entrenched and are so, and all of us, you know, to some extent, but that there is a segment of the population for whom they still think that way, that, oh, gender nonconformity means being a Vulcan. Like, they've literally never opened up TikTok or Instagram, and they've literally yeah. never seen the explosive joy and love surrounding the influencers that are out there in the front, you know, these wonderful non-conforming individuals who are celebrating things that are, you know, historically male, things that are historically female, and things that are historically both and neither. You know, you have these incredible makeup artists and fashion designers and just individuals who embody such creativity online. And I mean, I think as a young person, it's almost hard not to experience this kind of influence. But as an older person, you can be removed from this and never be exposed to it.
Yeah, I completely agree. This is one of these situations where I really do feel like the kids are all right. Like, they are on it, right? It's just not hard for them, right? Like, my daughter, she's 8, right? Mm-hmm. My partner is trans. He's a trans man, right? And so her first experience of like learning about trans people, trans existence. So, I mean, she kind of like, maybe she would have known about it a little bit, but really her first experience of learning about trans people was meeting my trans partner. This was about 2 years ago. And she's like, oh, okay. Right. Like, no big deal. She's never misgendered him. It's just not a big deal.
Right.
For kids.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And it's like, oh yeah, obviously this is the case. Right. And again, I think you're right to point to TikTok and Instagram, because like all of these different expressions of like what's possible. Right? There's a character on RuPaul's Drag Race this season, a character, I shouldn't say a contestant, whatever they are, a person on Drag Race the semester, who's a trans man who dresses in drag.
Oh, wow. I love that.
Right. Yeah. And it's just this incredible articulation of like, these are the possibilities, right? So you're sort of like, because again, what's so wonderful about drag, we get this from Judith Butler, is the idea that drag queens show us that gender is a performance, right? So they're hyperbolically performing femininity. And in part, what they're doing is they're reminding us that the rest of us are performing gender as well, right? The world really is a stage. It's just that some of us have forgotten that we're playing parts here. Right. And drag queens are so wonderful, both for the creative expression and the different ways of playing with gender and messing with it, but also just for reminding us that this really is a performance that all of us can do. Right. And so, yeah, I think you're right. The youth really are on the vanguard of this. And it's exciting for me as a kind of old to see.
Come on.
Quasi old. I don't know.
But you know what kind of gives me the sads too is thinking about the way, and you articulate this so well in your book, thinking about the way that these waves of change have occurred over time, that there are the people at the bleeding edge, there are the people kind of in a more moderate stance, and that, of course, the arc bends in a more progressive way, but there are these dams that have to be pushed through. And that, unfortunately, the drag queen is the icon that we have. And I'm not saying unfortunately because I love drag queens, but that the drag king is not the icon. That women, on the whole, and individuals who have identified themselves as being within gender minorities have been more accepting of these movements. So, of course, a drag queen, and whether it's a cis man dressing up as a woman or a trans man, you know, identifying as that female gender on stage, you know, regardless of who's actually performing the, as you said, like the extreme version of the gender masquerade, we are more as a culture accepting of a man in drag than a woman in drag.
I think, let me think about this. So I think in some ways that's right. I wonder if it categorizes as neatly as that. Cause I think in some ways women are actually much more free to express masculine characteristics than men are.
I think
has to do with homophobia.
I think you're right.
A tomboy is okay.
Yeah.
Right. So a little girl who's a tomboy, she's fine. Right. Whereas a little boy who's a little bit effeminate, like, even like fairly progressive parents have a hard time with that. Right. And in part, I think what's going on is that those, like, the parents of a tomboy have this sense that, like, okay, like, masculine characteristics are the things that you need to get ahead in our society. Mm-hmm. Like, things like assertiveness and confidence. And so, of course, you'd want that for your kid. You want her to get ahead. Right. So it's a little bit easier to kind of foster that in your little girl tomboy than it is in your boy who likes to wear dresses.
Yeah.
Right. Because there's a sort of like, because femininity is so derogated in our society, right? That there's a sort of sense of like, of course, a little girl would want the boy stuff. Everybody does. Boys get the cool stuff. Right. And like, whether we're talking, you know, trucks or philosophy, right? Or science, right? Boys get the cool stuff, right? So of course girls would want that. It makes sense for them to want that, right? But a boy who's willingly kind of like foregoing his the privilege that is his birthright, mm-hmm. like that threatens to like upend the whole system.
You're right.
And so I think this explains why, for example, we see a lot of violence against trans women, incredible amount of violence against trans women of color, right? Because like, so Julia Serrano is this fabulous trans author. And she talks about how she actually says that she thinks that a lot of the violence that trans women experience has less to do with transphobia and more to do with just straight up misogyny.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So the thought here is that, you know, like this is someone who could have had all of the privileges of masculinity and gave it up. And that's threatening to us. And it's threatening to the world, like the entire worldview we have that prioritizes masculinity over femininity.
Interesting. So within this kind of full cultural milieu, especially the cultural milieu in which cis white men tend to still maintain the majority of the power, in order to act like a man is aspirational, but to act like a woman is somehow some sort of betrayal of one's gender.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like you're demeaning yourself.
I agree, you know, and I think I stand corrected. I think part of my perspective that I was thinking about, mostly because I've been rewatching The L Word.
Oh, God,
which,
so good.
Which is so good. There are obviously some problems
some
with it.
Some of it ages a little better than others, but
but so good. And I was thinking almost like within the queer community, where is the acceptance higher? Because you do see these social kind of waves of, you know, drag queens dominate the drag bars, and are gay men or at least queer men more accepting of the trans kind of movement within their subculture than, let's say, queer women, and queer women affirming their more male characteristics and owning their trans male characteristics if they have them. And I don't know, you know, I think it's hard. What I'm interested in,
it's complicated.
It's really complicated. And I think what I was trying to get to was this idea that there are waves of gender movement. There's kind of the first wave, second wave, third wave feminist movement that it's like, we got there a little, then we got there more, then we got there more. And I was hoping that you might be able to help us break that down, because I wonder how much that informs the complicated gender violence, the complicated gender non-acceptance, even sometimes within queer communities.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think, honestly, I want to be really careful about saying, about sort of stepping outside of my area of expertise here, because I'm not a queer theorist, mm-hmm. right? I mean, these are blurry lines. Mm-hmm. But I think I would want to defer to someone who actually sort of centers their work sort of,
sure.
you know, okay. firmly in queer theory to really kind of be able to answer this sort of thing. Just because I think that you're right. You're definitely pointing to dynamics that exist within the queer community, right? Where you have a subset of lesbian women really, really not being accepting of trans men, because there's this sort of like fear that all of the butch dykes are going to disappear. Mm, right. Mm-hmm. I've had lesbian women say that to me, right. They find out I have a trans man as partner, and they're like, oh, but like, we're not going to have any, like, I just love dykes. I'm like, I like dykes too. But that like why would my sexual preference get to determine who someone gets to be? Right. Like,
right.
That's crazy. Right?
right. Right.
But I think you're right that like that does exist within the queer movement. And again, but then also like, within the queer movement, cis white gay men tend to have the most power, tend to be the ones who get to be the ones who determine what counts as the priorities for the movement. And I think that's starting to change, but it's still taking a lot of time.
Yes.
But again, this is, I want to be clear, like this is not my central area of research expertise. So
for sure.
I think definitely what you're going to have to do is get a queer theorist on
yes,
the podcast.
Yes. and maybe we can talk about some recommendations after the show for sure. But it's interesting that it does show that the bias is deep. You know, these biases that were carved out over thousands of years within our society and our culture as it evolved, they run deep. And I think one of the
they
things
really
that
do.
Came up for me, and maybe this is less about kind of queer theory, but more about feminist theory, is this concept of the TERF, you know, the trans-exclusionary radical feminist, the idea that there are people who are feminists yet are anti-trans, which seems to fly in the face of feminist thought.
Yes, this is. I'm going to put my cards on the table here and say I actually don't think that. So the term TERF itself is controversial because TERFs, when I say it, they've decided it's a slur for some reason, but it's just an acronym that stands for Trans Exclusionary Radical Feminist. I'm like, okay, this is just a descriptively accurate characterization of your view.
Well, it's kind of like radical feminist, it's kind of like SJW, right? Like people call me SJW and they think it's like a bad word, and I'm like, yeah, I'm a social justice warrior.
Exactly.
Deal with it.
Exactly. I'm so badass. So TERFs grumble about that, but I mean, I want to say, fine, you're not a TERF because I don't think you're a feminist, because no one gets to call herself a feminist if she doesn't actually care about the, you know, how all women are doing, and trans women are women,
right?
So like, mic drop, we're done.
Good,
right?
I like that, clearing the air on that. Good. Good.
I actually do talk a lot about the TERF wars in Think Like a Feminist, because I think it's something that's really, really important. I do have a dog in this fight because my partner's trans, but I actually wrote those sections of the book before I met him. So yeah, it was a fun coincidence. And I have to say, as someone who's done public philosophy for four or five or 6 years now at this point, I've gotten used to kind of like, you publish an op-ed in the New York Times and you get some hate mail and like whatever, right? And I'm sort of used to pissing off a certain kind of person when I talk about feminism in the New York Times or something like that, right? And I sort of think, okay, like if I'm not pissing that person off, then I'm not doing my job, right? You know, if they're, you know, like they want to write me with some like xenophobic sexist stuff about, you know, like, oh, if you feminists get your way, your daughter's going to be wearing a burqa. I'm like, I'm glad I made you angry. Bad man, right? Like, that's fine, right? But the feedback I've gotten when I started writing op-eds about trans issues has been both like incredibly more vitriolic and incredibly, so in terms of quality and quantity, it's just been so much worse. And it, again, and it's from people who are supposed to be feminist allies, people who identify themselves as feminists, but are really, really, really reticent to hop on board with the thought that trans women are women. So I actually, I run through what I take as a pretty definitive argument in Think Like a Feminist for why trans women are obviously women. And basically the move is this, it's pretty straightforward, right? All you do is you point out that the history of feminism, which I discuss in the book, is a history of relatively privileged women using their experiences and generalizing over them to sort of steer the ship of the feminist movement, right? So we have, you know, Betty Friedan, who's a sort of classic second wave feminist. She writes in The Feminine Mystique, right, that there's this problem that has no name. And she's sort of responsible for starting all of these consciousness raising groups that we saw in the 60s and 70s. Right. So the thought is that basically all of these, you know, rich white women in the suburbs were bored, and you know they used their university degree to get the MRS degree. They got a nice husband, and they're in the suburbs and sort of post-war prosperity, and they're supposed to be satisfied, right? But they were just miserable. Right. And so Betty Friedan gives them a name for this. It's the problem that has no name. And they discuss it. And so we get the idea that the personal is political, right? That there's this, you know, that women can band together and in solidarity and improve the lot for all women. And that was like important as far as it went, right? But even Friedan was just like completely clueless in realizing that, you know what, things are probably worse for the underpaid domestic help, who's almost certainly a woman of color, that these bored rich housewives were underpaying so that they could go to their consciousness raising groups. Right. And so the history of feminism really is this history of like prioritizing the interests of cis white women, right? We saw it in the fight for the vote in the first wave, right? Where the suffragists like Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony were just shockingly racist. Right.
Right. Yet they used and they talked black to one of them. Voices and yes. black power to serve their cause. Yeah. And the minute that they were to get any sort of credit, it was like, no, you can't show up now. We need you to hide from us.
Yeah, exactly. Ugh. Yeah. Yeah. No, the history of the anti-abolition movement and the feminist movement, but it's fascinating stuff. I talk a little bit about it in the book. But again, so you look at the history of feminism and you realize it's a history of white women saying, this is what feminism is. It's women's rights, but really what they mean is women like me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? Women who are already privileged enough to have people in society listen to them and take them seriously.
But in a way, I don't want to say that's how it had to go, but that's in many ways why that was the first movement, right? Because they had a platform.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So you can say, you know, there's an explanation, if not a justification, for why this is the way the history went. Mm-hmm. That's fine. But at some point, you got to start learning from history.
Right.
Right. And so I think what we're doing now, or what TERFs are doing now, is failing to learn from history. And so when they say that a trans woman isn't a real woman because she's not a real woman, born woman, right? So they say that you have to have been born a woman in order to count as a woman. What they're really saying is trans women haven't had experiences like me. And that's exactly the mistake that feminists keep making historically. And like, and at least now I think we're identifying the problem, thanks to third wave feminists who by and large were feminists of color. Mm-hmm. we're starting to realize our mistakes and stop making them, right? Because the thing is, when you actually look at the experiences of trans women, not all trans women have the experiences of Caitlyn Jenner.
Right, exactly. Just that, you know,
yeah, right. Caitlyn Jenner is this incredibly privileged, very conservative, regressive woman, right, with this very regressive conception of femininity, right, where she says, you know, the hardest thing about being a woman is figuring out what to wear, right? So of course, like a radical feminist who spent her entire life like trying to get people to think critically about these really narrow, regressive conceptions of femininity, of course she's going to be pissed off at Caitlyn Jenner. We're all pissed off at Caitlyn Jenner,
right?
The thought is that maybe Caitlyn Jenner shouldn't be the spokesperson for the trans movement. Like there are a ton of trans people whose conceptions of gender don't just reify these really regressive stereotypes, right? It's just that they're not the ones who get their own reality TV shows.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting when you talked about this idea that what they were really saying is that their experiences are not like mine. And for that reason, they're not valid. In a way, it's also like they're saying their experiences are not like mine, and mine embody what this truly means. Mine embody the real version. And in some ways, it's a bit of an oppression Olympics. It's a bit of and I actually struggled, when frustratingly, that view is wildly lacking in empathy for the deep, dark struggles that just aren't out in the forefront because they're taboo to talk about.
No, that's right. That's right. And the thing is, and then once you start pushing on exactly this point that you're pushing about, you say, okay, so then fine, TERF, what is it like? What does it mean to be a woman? Tell me what you think your essence is. Then suddenly they start giving, like they're forced to, like you're painted into this corner where they have to start giving you this story that sounds like the kind of like really, really flat-footed gender essentialism that is exactly what feminism rejects, right? Right. So, and so then you start looking, okay, what experiences do trans women have? Well, they have, much higher risk of sexual violence at the hands of men. Well, like all women have that. Trans women actually have more of that than cis women, right? They have, the experiences of gender. So the thought is, and again, I talk a lot more about this in Think Like a Feminist, using weirdly enough the philosophy of Ludwig Wittgenstein. So you can use Wittgenstein and his idea of a family resemblance concept to understand how we should think about gender, right? So just as you can't. Right. So just as you can't give like a necessary and sufficient condition for like what counts as a chair. Right. The thought is maybe we can't, again, like some chairs have four legs. Most chairs have four legs, but some of them have three. Right. And then most chairs have a back. But like, is a stool a chair? I don't know. Right. Again, the thought is you can't give necessary and sufficient conditions for chairhood. But you kind of know one when you see it. Right. Just like, it's called family resemblance, right? Just like you can kind of see the different members of a nuclear family and they all kind of look similar, even though they're not the same, right? So sometimes philosophers call this a cluster concept or a family resemblance concept. And the thought here is that you have this kind of like open-ended, revisable list of interrelated sub-concepts that make up what that concept is, right? And so I say in the book that this is a nice way to think about gender, right? So gender is a lot of things, right? It's the experience of having a certain kind of body, usually, but not always, right? A body that menstruates. Do all cis women menstruate? No, right? Do all cis women have babies? No. Do many? Yeah. Okay, so that goes on the list, right? So, but the thing is, like, if you're a cis woman who hasn't had a baby and doesn't plan to, or do you still count as a woman? Yep. And so you get this really kind of robust, open-ended, in principle, revisable list of characteristics that make up gender. And once you start doing that, you realize, of course, trans women count as women.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and it reminds me of this categorical way that so many of us think that makes it really, really hard for a lot of people to shake themselves out of that box. I was told a story by a wonderful individual who is, I think, is still a PhD student in my program, or maybe has since graduated and is a psychologist now. But a trans man who is telling us a story about living in a pretty regressive part of the country and needing to find a doctor, a primary care physician. And, you know, found out this is the doctor. This is the doctor that, you know, people in our community go to. Don't worry. They understand. They're very empathic and they'll help you. So he went and saw this doctor and he was, as expected, very kind, very empathetic. But there was a point in time where they were scheduling the next session. And he said to his doctor, okay, so I probably need to get, an annual exam and just make sure everything's checked out. And he was like, okay, so we'll make sure that we look at the prostate. And he was like, I don't have a prostate. And the doctor could not fathom this. And it was like, how, as a physician who is supposed to be knowing how to treat trans men, how is it that your categorical thinking is, and it took like 5 minutes before finally the doctor was like, oh my God, you're right. Of course you don't have a prostate. And of course we need to do a Pap.
That's bizarre.
It was so, and it makes me think that even somebody like a physician who maybe doesn't see that many trans individuals, but is gender confirming and is very open, is still going to fall back on these categorizations. And certain things are like, don't compute, very confused. And that's why I think sometimes when I talk to my friends who are trans and, you know, there'll be instances where people get misgendered and it's like, don't freak out, just quickly correct. You're going to make mistakes. This is new for a lot of people to operate with these kinds of mentalities, and that's okay. There's going to be a learning curve.
And so, yeah, so I really do think, and the kind of feminism that I'm really sort of most at home in is one that kind of like knows the history, like understands the mistakes, and understands that if and when the movement has progressed, it's because we've learned to listen to people at the margins, right? So we got the third wave of feminism from Kimberly Crenshaw, right, who gives us this idea of intersectionality, right, who gives us this idea of like realizing that we can't just like that we can't think of gender or like gender and race and sexuality as these kind of like pop beads that we pull apart and disambiguate. Like it's all messed up. We have to be able to sort of theorize people's experiences as they actually exist, and we can't just abstract away, because when we do that, that abstraction, really what we tend to do is actually just kind of like entrench very privileged perspectives, like, you know, like those of white women, right? So we learn this by listening to women of color, right? And I really do think that the feminist movement is at this moment where I think like we have the most to learn from trans people, right? Our understandings of gender and of sexuality they're not really going to reflect human reality until we actually start listening to these people, right? Because we have this idea that there are only two biological sexes. Okay, but no biologist thinks that anymore, right? Like,
yeah.
The reality is just that it's much more nuanced than that. So Anne Fausto Sterling is a feminist biologist who has this account of development of sexual development in the embryo that's just like layered, and it actually is just much more biologically accurate.
I'm so glad you mentioned Anne too. She's been on the show, so go back and listen to that episode. Yeah,
oh, really?
She's great.
Oh my gosh, I didn't know that. Wonderful. She is. So her work is incredible, right? And so she says, basically, if you look at like 1.7% of the population is intersex. And again, this is a sort of umbrella term to cover a lot of different kinds of intersex conditions. 1.7% of the population does not fit neatly into the box of, are you male or female, right? Like it's just so much more complicated than X chromosomes and Y chromosomes and estrogen and, you know, testosterone and everything else, right? And 1% might not strike you as very much, but it's also the percentage of redheads. And it's also the percentage of people who use a wheelchair to navigate the world, right? So you think about all of the modifications to our social world that we make for people who use wheelchairs. To be clear, we should be making way more, right? But we do make a lot, right? Like there's curb cuts, there's elevators, there's ramps, right? There's we're willing to change our physical world or material world for people who navigate the world in this way.
And
right?
We've adapted to that in such a way that you don't see people complaining. You don't say, oh, this damn ramp is in my way. Like it's just part of the world.
Exactly. Yeah. Everyone's just really happy to be able to take the elevator sometimes, you know? Yeah.
Right. And skaters, they love those ramps. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And parents pushing strollers love curb cuts, right?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. And so intersex people, again, like people who just don't fit neatly into the sex binary, like they're not asking for curb cuts. They're just asking for acknowledgement of their existence. Like that's free.
Absolutely. You know,
and still we're like, no, that's not possible.
You're so right. And that's, you know, I think sometimes people, and one thing that we didn't do in this episode, because I'm sort of benefit of the doubting my listeners here, because you guys have been with me now for like over 6 years, that, you know, basic terms like sex, like gender, like cis, trans, like knowing that when we talk about a trans man versus a trans woman, what that definition is, I've sort of baked them in and assumed them as we've been talking. But I know there's going to be a certain percentage of individuals who have listened to the episode so far and who are sitting there thinking, although cognitively I want to agree with what you're saying, I'm finding it confusing. I'm finding it overwhelming. And there's a part of me in my heart or my soul or my mind or however you want to define it that feels resistant to this. And so I guess
it's a lot of jargon.
Yeah. And so I guess my question for you is, you know, do you have any advice, any recommendations for how to sort of approach these kinds of conversations that have jargon, that might feel new, that have we're asking for paradigm shifts, for whom, you know, that for some people feel almost too much, and then they get that shutdown mode. It's like teaching science, right? There's always a certain portion of kids who are like, I'm never going to understand this. This is too hard. So they shut down. And in doing that shutdown, actually prevent the exciting and freeing knowledge to come in. So it's about getting them excited again. It's about helping push past that shutdown. Do you have any sort of anything to say or any recommendations for those who are listening
yes.
right now? Okay.
Absolutely. And one thing is to sort of like just completely straight up admit that, like, if, you know, the average listener feels a bit swimming with all of these terms, like, it's not you, it's the term.
Right.
This stuff is new and it's shifting really, really quickly. Like, this really is the vanguard of this kind of like intellectual research and these kind of research programs. And so even just terms that would have been standard 5-10 years ago, they've now shifted, right? So don't feel bad if you're like, what? Right. That said, on page 118 and 119 of my book, I just lay it out for exactly the care of the reasons that you're saying. Like there's just so much stuff going on mm-hmm. that it's just like, all right, we're just going to sit here. We're going to find some terms. Right. So yeah, page 118 of my book, if you want to pick it up, or I can talk you through them right now as well.
Well, you know, I think that's a perfect example, like a perfect reference that you've given. I'm going to continue on with this assumption that like most of the people that are listening right now are somewhat familiar with the terminology we've used, and they were able to kind of piece this together through context clues. And for those who are like, I'm overwhelmed, but I do give a shit. Obviously, not just for those, but for everybody, pick up the book, pick up Think Like a Feminist, because you will learn so much and you will challenge your own preconceptions, and you'll come out of it feeling a little more prepared and a little more comfortable and safe, and seeing the positive benefit of being more open to a world that's inclusive and diverse for everybody. You know, Carol, I do know that you were running low on time, and I do want to ask you my final two questions. But another thing that comes to my mind, I feel like it's a responsibility of mine to kind of ask, and maybe I'm putting you on the spot here, but a lot of my listeners know me through the skeptic movement. And so they may be exposed, or they may actually really respect a lot of intellectual thinkers, scientific thinkers who have great ideas in some respects, and some pretty regressive ideas in others. So for those who are listening, who really do respect and honor thinkers that have now been kind of identified with what we call the quote intellectual dark web movement, you know, individuals like, let's say, Richard Dawkins or Sam Harris, or maybe on the worst end of it, Jordan Peterson, people who, you know, I obviously... less so with Sam. Sam's a tougher one for me, but definitely more so with Jordan Peterson, where I've kind of been able to say, okay, I disavow this person, because even if they've got a few things right, they've got so many things wrong. It's painful for me to listen to how wrong they are all the time about these social issues. But for a lot of my listeners, these are, you know, intellectual giants for whom they really respect, and trying to figure out how to square that circle. How to exist in a world to say, I respect this person's thoughts on this thing, but not on that other thing. And I don't know what I'm asking from you, but I'm wondering, have you grappled with this? Have you spoken with people who are like, but wait, Richard Dawkins is so important for evolutionary psychology, but he said some really evolutionary biology, but he said some really boneheaded things on Twitter. And now I don't know how to think or feel about this.
I mean, I think in general, you know, didn't the post-structuralist say that the author is dead, right? Like it's sort of by definition, like possible to take the artist out of the work, right?
Right.
Like, when I'm not doing feminist philosophy, I do Kantian philosophy, right? So like I'm someone who uses the work of someone who's just on the books as being incredibly racist and sexist and homophobic.
Oh, same.
Right?
I use Heidegger. I use Heidegger and he was a freaking Nazi.
He's a Nazi.
Yeah. It's like, oh shit.
Exactly.
I did not practice what he preached.
No. Yeah, exactly. Right. So I think when you're doing this kind of work, I think it is possible to do it, but I don't think it's necessarily like you can't just be like, oh, I'm just going to extract the really, really awful stuff he says and pretend that it doesn't ramify. I think if you're going to do that, you actually have the intellectual obligation to make sure it's not ramifying and to make sure it's not ramifying in ways that maybe aren't like obvious. Right. And so I think that like if you're someone who's going to use Kant or Heidegger or Dawkins, and by use I mean either like write philosophy books about them or just kind of like use their worldview to support your own, right? Then you have an intellectual obligation to really, really interrogate that and go back again and again and again and again and make sure that these really, really problematic biases that you should disavow aren't sneaking in or doing some kind of motivating work. So I think you just have to be really, really kind of humble about it and not just say, oh, like, of course we could just extract this stuff. I think it's possible to extract it. I mean, it's really what I try to do with Kant, but I also am really, really open to the possibility that maybe no, like maybe we should really just throw the, like, maybe there's no, the metaphor I use is throwing the baby out with the bathwater. The thought is we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. There's something good here, right? I think if you're going to do this, you really need to be open to the possibility that there's no baby,
right?
Or that the baby's not worth saving.
Yeah.
Right. Because it's all just corrupt. And again, I think that's going to be a kind of lifelong project. I mean, I think that, you know, like real people are complicated. It's, you know, like justice is hard. Right. So I think, you know, it's, you know, there's, if the people we look to be sort of heroes of justice, you know, people who we sort of want to model our lives after, if they have to be perfect, there aren't going to be any, right? So if we're willing to like overlook Martin Luther King's sexism or, you know, Gandhi's sexism, right, or these sorts of things, right, then you know, maybe we can do the same for Dawkins, right? But again, but it's like, I think as a follower or as someone who, a devotee of someone's worldview, I think we have to be really careful and circumspect and humble and willing to revise our commitments at all times.
Oh, what a beautiful way to encapsulate that, you know, that there's a risk benefit analysis to all of it. Was the thing that we are identifying them as an ethical giant, ethical enough to supersede these other things, you know, can we square that circle? And it's a lifelong process, like you said, that our heroes are flawed and we are flawed as well. And I think that giving ourselves a little bit of slack, cutting ourselves a little bit of slack as we learn and we stumble and we make mistakes and saying, you know, the point is not to be perfect, because if we try to be, it's just like with drug and alcohol treatment, we often talk about the point is not to never F up. Because if the minute you F up, everything comes crashing down, you're never going to get through this. You're going to fall off the wagon. You got to be able to get back on. Oh, Carol, so much here.
And I do think that
yeah.
And just one more thing. I do want to say that I think that this really does involve like this attitude of humility that I'm talking about. It involves a willingness to listen to people who are telling you that you're wrong.
Yes.
Right. It involves a willingness to listen to the, so if Jordan Peterson, right, he has this like really shitty view of women and mm-hmm. gender essentialism and like, oh, right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
As a fellow Canadian, he makes me really sad. Let's just say that. Right.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, if someone's going to be a devotee of Jordan Peterson, and if they're going to do that in a good faith way, then they have a duty to listen to women who say Jordan Peterson is not just wrong, but has a worldview that's harmful to people like me.
Mm-hmm.
Like you actually have to listen to people who are on the receiving end of this shit, and not, you can't just listen to other people who are in your privileged group.
Yeah. Don't minimize those voices, you know, listen to them and start to figure out how can I modify my thinking based on these inputs? Don't justify them away. Yeah. Oh, what incredible advice. I mean, and that's really the hallmark, I think, of skeptical thought is I am going to go into things skeptically but open, and I'm going to revise and modify. I'm going to admit when I'm wrong, and I'm going to adjust my thinking based on available evidence. And the truth is, the experience of individuals is valid, available evidence. And we need to listen.
I think skepticism at its best is this incredible articulation of humility. Mm-hmm. Right. I think skepticism at its worst is arrogance.
Oh, I completely agree. And a lot of women have been on the show and told me behind the scenes about their terrible experiences in the skeptic community as well.
For I've that had reason. Them as well.
Yep. You know, we all know. And, you know, I could, I could share a bit as well and have before as well. So Carol, you know, I always close my show asking the same two big questions from my guests. But before I ask them, I'm wondering, is there anything, obviously there's so many things we didn't get a chance to talk about, but is there anything that sticks out to you where you're like, oh, I'd be remiss if we didn't go there? Or I don't know, is there a big gaping hole in this conversation?
I could go all night. This is so much fun, but I think we've covered all the main things.
Good. Okay, great. So now I'm going to put you on the spot and I'm going to ask you these big picture questions. And they have to do with kind of thinking about the future, as you oft do as a philosopher, as well as thinking about the past. When you think about the future, in whatever context is relevant to you right now, it could be personal, it could be in your work, it could be even more global than that. Number one, what is the thing that does keep you up at night, that's disconcerting, that worries you, that maybe you're even a bit cynical about or pessimistic about? And on the flip side of that, what are you genuinely, authentically hopeful for? What are you looking forward to?
I would say that the long dark tea time of the soul nights for me are fed by the culture wars, right? The thought that just the polarization, the rise of fascism, I think that we're seeing in this country, right? This thought that like I really do think that as human beings, we have made social progress. We the arc is bending towards justice, and it happens in fits and starts. And I really am fundamentally optimistic that we're going in the right direction. But some days I'm terrified. I'm terrified that like Trump didn't get impeached, and that means that he's not legally prohibited from rising again. And if anyone knows the history of Nazi Germany, that's what happened to Hitler.
Yeah.
Right.
Like
stuff like this. Right. So I think the idea that like people don't even want to listen to each other anymore, and we're just kind of like yelling at straw man versions of each other. And the rise of populism, the suspicion about elitism being turning into a kind of like denigration of the idea of expertise at all. Like it's a bit sort of anti-intellectual. It's terrifying. So that whole like basket of shit, but what makes me so hopeful, I think, is the stuff in, I guess, on my side of the culture war, right? The incredible gains that I think that we're seeing in the trans movement. I think that I've got a friend who's got a trans kid who is, has access to puberty blockers and all of these things. And this kid is just flourishing, right? He's a soccer phenom, and he's just doing incredibly well. And like that wouldn't have been possible even 5 or 10 years ago, right? And so I think that we are, we're discovering new ways to be as humans. And I think again, as I was saying earlier, I think the queer movement is leading the way in some way. And I think that it's really exciting. I think it's setting this next generation up for just like incredible sex lives and incredible ways of relating to each other and like incredible friendships and incredible, love. And the way we're moving in terms of those sorts of things, I think, is really exciting and new, and it's something we've never seen before. And it's it makes me excited to sort of see. I'm really excited to see what the world is like for my daughter when she comes of age. She's 8 now, right? And I just think that in many ways, her world is going to be really exciting.
Agree. And we can all contribute to that if we think like a feminist. Everyone, make sure that you pick up Carol's book, Think Like a Feminist, The Philosophy Behind the Revolution, written by Dr. Carol Hay. Thank you so much, Carol. This was just so informative and such an important conversation.
Thanks so much for having me, Carol. It was a pleasure.
And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk to you.